There are also some specialized purpose registers that are used to keep track of the various code segments and data segments to make it easier for the program to address its instructions and its data. We're not going to refer to them directly in the course. So just a quick little example of how the EIP register is used. Let's say you have instructions listed on the right side of the slide, sub and push and push. How does the program know which instruction is going to execute next? Well, the CPU maintains that information in the EIP register. So initially, EIP points to 40174, so that's why the instruction located there is going to be executed. And the CPU will continue to execute these instructions sequentially until it reaches a jump. Now, jump changes the flow of execution, and in this case, it's a jump to 40288. So the CPU will update EIP to point to 40288, and that's where it's going to continue its execution. So we're going to be looking at registers quite a bit. We're also going to be looking, of course, at instructions to understand, well, what is the program actually doing? And when you look at an instruction, of course, you will need to understand what the operation itself is supposed to do, but also you will see that an operation can take some arguments. Some operations have zero arguments, some have one, some have two, and arguments are sometimes called operands, by the way. And sometimes operands are implied, so you don't see them explicitly, but you need to know that a particular operation uses some operands behind the scenes. I'm going to show you those examples. Here's an example. Move EIX 6453. Here's an instruction. The operation is move, and if you're not sure what move does, you can look it up. We should know what move does. It's very common. Move copies data from one place to another. By convention that we're going to follow in this course, because that's the convention that Intel follows, and that's the convention that our tools will follow, by convention, the destination of a move instruction will be listed first. So what's happening here is that we're moving the value 6453 into the register EAX. So after this instruction finishes executing, EAX will contain in it 6453, the value 6453. So it's a bit of a misnomer. Move instruction should have been really called copy. It's not like it's grabbing the data and actually moving it and removing it from the original place. It's really a copy. It places one value into another location. These operands can be a register. As you can see, here's a register operand. These operands could also be an immediate value, the actual value itself. Like in this example, 6453 is the immediate value. And also, an operand could be a memory location. I wanted to mention this terminology to you because as you read documentation and tutorials and books, these are the terms that people are going to use. Operands are the same thing as arguments. This is an immediate value, 6453. This is a register, EAX. And you could also have a memory at location. When you look at these instructions, there are several ways in which assembly can represent memory locations. Sometimes it could be the immediate address itself, like let's say the address 6453. Actually, you know what? Yeah, it could be the immediate address itself or the immediate data. Or you might need to calculate the address. Let me show you an example of this. Let's see. Ah, this is the best way to do it. Let's say we have an instruction listed on the slide on page 32. It's a move of something into the EAX register. This is the notation that you need to be familiar with. What is being moved into the EAX register? Well, if we did not have square brackets here, then we would be moving this immediate value, the data, 8048-1234, into EAX. But we have square brackets here, and square brackets means that this is a pointer. So what it's going to move into EAX is not this data itself. Instead, it's going to move into EAX whatever data resides at the address 8048-1234. This is called direct memory addressing because the address is directly listed here. What's being moved into EAX? Whatever data is at this address. The convention that our tools will follow is putting the address in square brackets. If there are no square brackets, then this is data. If there are square brackets, then this is a pointer to where the data is located. This is how OLLI debug will represent it, in square brackets. IDA Pro uses a slightly different convention. It's going to use the dword tag to indicate that this is a pointer, instead of square brackets sometimes. It's the same thing. Square brackets or dword, the way IDA Pro will represent it. If there is no dword, this is immediate value. If this is dword or square brackets, that means that this is an address. And in this case, because the address is written here directly, this is direct memory addressing. There's another way in which you could address data. I'm going to show it to you shortly. But first, a few examples to make sure you feel comfortable reading this syntax. Move EAX 6453. What we're doing here is moving this data, 6453, into EAX. So this is the immediate value that we're placing into EAX. We have another example, IMUL EAX. IMUL does some multiplication operation, and the operand is a register, not an immediate value as in the previous example, but a register. And here's another example, move into EBX, dword 403028. Because there's dword, we treat this as a pointer, so we're placing into EBX whatever data happens to reside at the address 40328. And at the bottom here, it's exactly the same thing, it's just a slightly different convention because we're using square brackets. We're moving into EBX whatever data resides at the address 403028. This is called direct memory addressing because the address is directly written right here. What's the size of the addresses? So the address space in 32 bits will typically be, the address is going to be double word. So that's what dword indicates. But you're correct. If you've got a very large value that's longer than that, you won't be able to store it in a single register. So that's why on a 64-bit platform where there are more addresses that need to be addressable, you've got, it's called a quad word. And there are special registers that are longer than EAX for storing that data. But we're talking about 32-bit platforms here. 64 bits operate almost the same way, except that you've got additional registers to keep track of because they need to be able to store these longer memory addresses. Mm-hmm. So you're correct. Yes, the bottom example is the processor will notice that this is supposed to be an memory address rather than an immediate value, and it'll go to this memory address, grab the data stored there, and place it into the destination, which in this case is EBX. Yeah. And one more way of addressing data before I have a little exercise for you. Sometimes you might not see this memory address directly listed. You might see a calculation there. And the syntax that Intel supports can be quite advanced. So here's an example. You see on the top, we see square brackets, which means it's going to be a pointer to some memory address. But this is not an immediate value. It's an EAX register. So the CPU will compute during runtime this memory address. This is called indirect memory addressing because the address is not directly listed there. It's going to be in whatever EAX happens to be when this instruction executes. And you can even do more complex things. You can say in square brackets, which means that this is going to be a memory address, you can say, you know what, calculated dynamically, it's going to be EBP plus 33A2. The syntax can even support multiplication, like EAX plus EB times 4. And so the CPU will compute these addresses on the fly by being able to do addition and multiplication as part of a single instruction. This is called indirect memory addressing because you don't see the actual address here. The address is going to be computed dynamically when the program runs. And so you can have complex things like EAX plus EBX plus some value, for example. And where this is used is in trying to reference complex data structures. For instance, I got an example here that's documented in your notes. I'm going to introduce it to you a little bit briefly. Let's say you've got a program, let's say it's a bot, an IRC bot, that knows how to connect to three different IRC networks, and for each network, the bot knows how to connect to three different servers using their IP addresses. A programmer might represent those nine values as a two-dimensional array. array is a special data structure where you can reference a particular value using its index. So you can say, give me the fifth value, give me the third value, or the first value. A two-dimensional array is an array of arrays. So each value within an array is going to be another array. And so a two-dimensional array is like an Excel spreadsheet. It's like a matrix. For a program to easily be able to reference these various values, it's very efficient to use this concept of indirect memory addressing, because a program might say, you know what, give me value, but compute the address of that value using EBX plus ECX times 4 plus some kind of a displacement. And so a program during runtime can very efficiently navigate through that two-dimensional array, and the processor can do it very, very quickly. I'm not going to get too deep into this. If you're interested in how this works, you've got some more details in your notes to page 36. So what I want to do now, and I've been talking for a while and you've been very patiently listening, which I appreciate, I want to do a quick exercise. And in this case, you don't need to use your virtual machines. I just want you to answer these questions. Take a few minutes to answer these questions. This is to make sure you understand the syntax and to make sure you understand the terminology. So the question is, for all four examples on slide 37, what type of addressing mode is used? What is it called? And, perhaps more importantly, what value is left in the EAX register after this instruction executes? So take a few minutes to think about it. I recommend writing down your answers in the book, and I'm going to go over the solutions in a couple of minutes. The solutions here. So we've got our first exercise, first example. Move EAX EBFE. Remember that the destination is listed first, so we're moving the value EBFE into EAX. This is the immediate value, the direct value itself. There is no memory addresses here because there are no square brackets. So at the end, EAX will contain EBFE. The second example, move into EAX D word 1234. This is how IDA Pro would show it to you. And number three is actually equivalent. This is just the way OliDebug would show it to you. Instead of D word, it uses square brackets. Because there is D word or square brackets, we're treating 1234 as the direct memory address. So what we're going to put into EAX is whatever happens to reside at the memory address 1234, and we told you that the data located there is 42. So EAX will contain in it 42. And these are all decimal values. This is direct memory addressing because the actual memory address is directly visible to you right there, right now. Number four is an example of indirect memory addressing. It's memory addressing because of square brackets, and it's indirect because the address is going to be dynamically calculated during runtime. And so the CPU will perform this calculation in one step on the fly, and it follows the standard order of execution, the standard order of operations. So multiplication is performed before addition or subtraction, before addition. So let's see, we had the numbers here. You got ECX times 2, which is 255 times 2, plus 4, plus 100, and the value is 614. So it's gonna load into EAX data that resides at the address 614, and it happens to be the value of 6453. So that's why in EAX we're gonna contain 6453. Any questions about this? The terminology, or more importantly, the effects of these operations? All right. A word about different syntax. So the conventions that we're following in this course, because that's what most of our tools will follow, it's the Intel convention. But there is this other convention out there called the AT&T syntax, and it's a little bit different. It takes a little bit of getting used to. I thought I'd mention to you that it exists, even though we're not going to use it in the course. One difference in convention that's pretty big is that AT&T lists the source first. Intel lists the destination first in the move instruction. That's a huge difference. Just convention. Also, AT&T, if you read AT&T documents or if you use tools that follow the AT&T convention, they will precede the register name with a percent sign. Intel doesn't bother with a percent sign. Immediate values in AT&T convention begin with a dollar sign. Intel doesn't bother with that. And most drastically, the AT&T convention, when it represents indirect memory addresses, so the way Intel would do it is just something that most human beings are used to reading. AT&T uses a, in my mind, a more convoluted syntax, but I think it's just because I'm not used to reading it. So it takes one of these values, the offset, and it brings it outside of the parentheses. And the other values it lists within parentheses. So to me it's a little bit weird, but I'm sure if I look at it enough, I'm going to get used to it. We're not going to follow this convention. We're going to use an Intel convention that I've been showing you so far, but I want you to realize that some tools and some documents do use the AT&T convention. Most notably, by default, GNU tools like GDB, the GNU debugger, by default will use the AT&T convention. However, GDB that's installed on your Linux virtual machine that I gave you, I changed its preferences to use the Intel convention. So now let's start looking at various instructions that you're likely to encounter when you analyze malware. And there are different types of instructions. They do different things. Some instructions manipulate data, like they subtract it, or they perform various Boolean operations. Some instructions are responsible for transferring data to and from memory locations or to and from registers. And some instructions are branching and conditional instructions. These instructions that are used to change the flow of execution, to change which instructions are going to be executed next. Yeah. Yep.
Does that do it in Intel because it's on
a... So you're saying, well, so GDB is a GNU debugger. By default, I saw GDB use the AT&T convention, and I think it follows that convention regardless of whether you're using it in Cygwin or on Linux directly. But you're going to see right away, if you see dollar signs and percent signs all over the place, that's the AT&T convention. And there's just a config file option that tells it to use a different convention if you don't like it. And because I'm used to Intel convention, that's how I configured it on Remnix. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the way branching occurs, because these instructions you're going to be looking at a lot, and you need to be familiar with them. So a branching instruction is an instruction like a jump or a call. This is an instruction that changes the flow of execution and tells the CPU to start executing code located elsewhere. And the side effect of that, of course, is that the CPU is going to update the value of the next memory, of the next instruction in the EIP register. To understand how these instructions work, we need to look at the various types of jumps, at various types of calls, and at looping instructions. So let's talk about jumps. Jumps begin with a J character. But following J might be one or two or three characters that indicate what kind of a jump it is. And here are some of these examples. So they're all going to start with J, but they might say JA, which says jump if above. You might have JNZ, jump if not zero. You might have something like JNGE, jump if not greater than or equal to. Different kinds of conditions are being tested here. These are conditional jump. So on the slide, I've got the explanation for the various acronyms. Z, for example, means zero. Now, you might be wondering, what's the difference between above and greater than? Sounds kind of similar, right? Or what's the difference between below and less than? They're very similar, except that greater than will perform greater than will perform signed comparison, while below, the sign of the values being compared won't matter. So the only difference is when whether the comparison is going to look at the sign of the values or not. Otherwise, it's similar. Now, you might be wondering, well, this is strange, because the phrase jump if above, it's not a proper English sentence. There is no subject here, right? Jump if what is above? Jump if what is not zero? To determine what is being compared here, we need to look at instructions that precede a jump. And these are the Boolean or arithmetic instructions that will precede a conditional jump. These are the instructions that will set the appropriate flags that will determine whether the jump will be taken or not. So when I say Boolean or arithmetic instructions, I mean instructions like add or compare or XOR. These instructions will perform a calculation, and as a side effect, they're going to set some flags in the eFlags register. And those are the flags that the jump instructions will look at. For example, let's say you have an instruction, add ECX to EAX. Yes, this instruction will add these two values together and store the result in the EAX register. But also, they will set a zero flag if to determine whether the result of the calculation was zero or not. So if you have a jump afterwards, that jump is going to look at the zero flag, and it will know whether the previous arithmetic or Boolean calculation produced zero. And similarly, an instruction like subtract will not only subtract numbers, but also it will set the zero flag, and it might also set a carryover bit if the subtract would have resulted in a carryover. Now, what if you want to just compare two values without subtracting them? As human beings, how do we compare two values? How do we know that 3 is greater than 1? Well, when you were first learning this, probably you had to subtract one value from the other. And if the result turned out to be negative, that means that that one of the values is larger than the other. So the way we compare two numbers is we subtract them. That's how a processor determines if the two values, whether one value is greater than the other. So what if we want to compare two values, but we don't want to change them? We don't really need to subtract them. We just want to know how one value compares to the other one. There are instructions that Intel supports. There are implied instructions. For example, if you don't want to subtract, but you just want to compare two values, there's the instruction CMP, compare. Compare will pretend to subtract two values, but all that it will really do is it will set the corresponding flags to determine whether the carryover bit would have been set. Similarly, if you want to test whether a value is 0 or 1, the way you would typically do it is you would use a Boolean operation AND. But AND would also change the value of the register that you're testing. So there's an instruction called test. It will pretend to do the AND, but it will not actually modify the register that's being compared to itself. It will only set the flags. Let's look at some examples, and it'll become a bit clearer. What I'm showing you here is a code excerpt from some synflooding tool. And we've got several jumps here. You know that these are jumps because they begin with a J character. And here's the first one on the top, JZ. JZ stands for jump if zero. But what's being compared to zero? Well, we've got to locate an arithmetic or a Boolean calculation above the jump statement. And here it is right there. It's a test. Now, test is an implied Boolean AND operation. A test determines whether a value of a register is zero or not. So the way you read this is you do not read the jump by itself. If you want to form a complete English sentence that tells you the meaning of the jump, you got to also locate the comparison, the Boolean operation above it. So the way you read this is jump if EDX is zero. You've got to look at both of these instructions to provide the appropriate meaning. Test compares EDX to see whether it's zero or not. The syntax is a little bit strange because you see test EDX, EDX. The reason you've got two values of EDX here is because test is an implied Boolean AND operation. If you remember your Boolean tables, AND is a Boolean operation that will only produce one if the two values are the same. So if you wanted to know if a register is zero or not, you do an AND of that register with itself, and if it's one, that means that the result is going to be one. If it's zero, that means that the result is going to be zero. So that's what test does. That's why the syntax is a bit weird. In most cases, you will see a register tested with itself, because really that's how you test whether that register is zero or not. Here's another example, JZ, jump if zero. So we're going to jump to this location if what is zero? Well, we've got to locate a Boolean or an arithmetic calculation above it, and here it is, dec. Decrements the value of a register by one. So we say jump if ECX is zero after this instruction was executed. Jump here if ECX is zero. That's how we read these instructions. Any questions about this? The concept is relatively straightforward, but it takes some getting used to the syntax. And what I want to do is give you an exercise to make sure you feel comfortable interpreting these jump statements. And to do this exercise, please fire up your Windows virtual machine. And we're not going to run any code right now. I just want you to start up IDA Pro. Start your Windows virtual machine and start IDA Pro. For this, by the way, we no longer need Slackbot or TNNBT. If you'd like, you're welcome to revert to when your system is not infected. Just make sure that you don't lose the tools that you've already installed. So this is a brand new exercise. We're not relying on the previous infection. Once you have IDA Pro running, look at the DVD that I gave you. In the malware directory, under day 3, you'll find a sample called SDBot. Please load SDBot into IDA Pro. And what I would like you to do, as is documented on page 47 in your book, is I want you to locate at a specific block of code between addresses 403.365 and 403.3E1. It's in your book on page 47. Look at that code block and identify 4 conditional jumps. There are going to be 4 conditional jumps there. Locate them. And for each jump, write out the acronym of what the jump stands for. Identify the address of the instruction that denotes the condition. Basically, write out the full sentence of what that jump means. That's the goal of this exercise. So we're loading SDBot into IDA Pro. If IDA Pro asks you any questions about how to load it, just accept the defaults. Scroll down to a given address range and locate and understand those 4 jumps. The solutions to this, I want to walk you through this. So what did I want you to do? Well, I wanted you to locate these instructions. And ultimately, I wanted you to be able to write out a full English sentence for what the instructions mean. And also, as I mentioned earlier, it's not enough to just locate a conditional jump. You also need to locate a corresponding conditional statement upon which the jump depends. So you've got this jump, J and Z. I wanted to make sure you know that J and Z stands for jump if not zero. Jump if not zero to a given address. But that's not enough. We need to find the conditional that determines whether the jump is taken. And right above, there is this compare function. So to read this properly, you would say jump if EAX is not zero. That's how you would determine this. This is a way of comparing EAX to zero. So jump if EAX is not zero. That's how you would read this. Any questions about this one? Well, let's look at another example. J and B. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yes, zero from EAX. Well, that's right. So compare will set a zero flag if the result, if EAX is equal to zero. Oh. Yes. Yep. Yeah, this is equivalent to test EAX. Test to see if EAX is zero. It's another way to do this is compare EAX to zero. Okay. So let's say EAX is five. Yeah, so let's say if EAX is 5, it's going to compare 5 to 0. So it's going to say jump if EAX is not 0, so it's going to jump if EAX is 5, let's say.
Okay.
So here's another example. Compare EAX to 3. So we're going to say jump if EAX is not below 3. So you read these together. By themselves, they're not all that meaningful.
Right.
So compare EAX to 3. So we're saying jump if EAX is not below 3. So you take these together and you read them as one sentence. Behind the scenes, you can write it down. You can say, all right, so compare is pretending to do a subtraction. So let me do the arithmetic calculation, subtract, let me set the appropriate flag, and then jump, if not below, is going to look at the corresponding flags. But it takes you a while. So instead, you trust that the CPU will do that properly, and you just get used to reading the syntax as jump if AX is not below 3. And yes, if you do the calculations behind the scenes, they should match your understanding. So I don't see the context of this particular instruction right now, but if you're saying that there was a strlen, then it was presumably comparing, determining the length of the string, placing it into EAX, and now it's jumping depending on the length of the string.
Right.
Yeah. So you're right. Right now we're focusing on these few instructions, but if you understand this, then you will start zooming out and saying, okay, within which context are these instructions used to understand their meaning? Absolutely correct. So more examples, JGE, jump if greater than or equal to, but we've got to do it in conjunction with the preceding comparison. H here means that 40 is a hexadecimal value, so we're saying jump if EAX is greater than or equal to 40 in hex. And similarly, JLE, jump if EAX is less than or equal to 0. Then we jump to this location. So the point is, it's not enough to know what the acronyms stand for. You need to find the calculation that it depends upon. That's the conditional statement. So let's take a break. We've got a 20-minute break. If you have any questions, please come on over. We can go through these examples. I'm happy to discuss them. Well, let's get going. What I want to cover next is build upon our understanding of relatively simple comparison statements and jumps, and start talking about higher level logic that ultimately is able to implement the intent of the programmer. And by high level logic, I mean the way a programmer might implement an if-else statement, the way a programmer might implement a loop. And the one thing I wanted to mention before we get into this discussion is this acronym that I got on the slide that's there really to remind me it stands for that there is more than one way to translate it. And that is to say that a different compiler or even the same compiler with different optimization options might produce slightly different assembly code given the same source code. More than one way to translate source code into functional assembly code. But if the compiler doesn't have a bug, whatever assembly code it produces should be functionally equivalent to what another compiler might produce under similar circumstances. So let's start by looking at the if-else statements, because this is a very common construct across most programming languages that I have seen. The idea here is that if you're writing a program in a language like C, as a programmer, you might want to test to see whether a particular condition is true or not, and then depending on whether that condition is true, you might execute one code block or another one. So as a programmer, you might say, if a given condition is true, execute the first code block. Else, execute the second code block, and then continue executing as normal. How would something like this get translated into assembly? Well, on the left side, you have pseudocode written in a language like C. If variable 1 equals to bad food, then execute the first code block. Otherwise, execute the second code block. Translate this into assembly. What does it look like? Well, let's look at the right side of the slide. We are using the register EAX to store the value that we're comparing. So our variable is going to be the EAX register, and we're going to say compare EAX to bad food. And here's the conditional jump that implements the conditional statement. JNE, jump if not equal. But what is not equal? Well, jump if EAX is not equal to bad food. We look at both of these statements to interpret the intent. So we're going to jump to code block 2 if EAX is not equal to bad food. So if it is equal to bad food, we're going to execute code block 1. And notice that at the end of the code block 1, there is an unconditional jump to the end. We want to hop over code block 2 because only one of these code blocks should be executed at a given time. So a lot of these conditionals, the way they're implemented is that the compiler creates assembly code that determines when to jump over the code block. So we compare EAX to bad food. If and we jump to code block 2 if AX is not equal to bad food. Any questions about this construct? As reversers, we will be presented with assembly code on the right side, and then we will need to, in our mind or in a piece of paper, create pseudocode that resembles what you see on the left side of the slide to really understand what's going on here. So you should be able to look at this code block and say, ah, I see that he's executing code block one or the other, depending on whether EAX is set to a particular value. Let's look at more complex if-else statements. These are known as nested if-else statements, because you can have several different comparisons. If condition one, execute code block one. Else if condition two, execute code block two. Else if condition three, execute code block three. And there's usually at the end some kind of a catch-all. If none of these conditions were met, well, here's our catch-all statement at the end. Execute this one. This is frequently used. Remember our Slackbot sample, TNNBTIB. We had looked at a block of code there that was performing several comparisons. It looked at a string that it received from the IRC channel, and it compared it to a string for which a given block of code was responsible. So it looked at that screen and it said, is that string sysinfo? If so, execute the code block that implements sysinfo functionality. Else, it said, look if that string is ID. If so, implement a functionality associated with ID. Else, compare it to another command. So the way the programmer typically implements that kind of functionality is using a nested if statement, a series of if-else statements. How do you translate them into assembly? Well, on the left side, we've got our pseudocode. If A is equal to 1, execute the first code block. Else, if A is equal to 2, execute the second code block. Otherwise, if none of these were true, then execute our third code block. Translate this into assembly, and we see code that is similar to what's on the right side. The first if, we compare EAX to 1. If it's not equal to 1, we jump to the second if. So if EAX is equal to 1, we execute our first code block, and we're done with this at first. When we're done with the first code block, we jump to the end. So if we're here at second if, that means that EAX was not 1. Well, let's compare it to 2. If it's not 2, then we jump to the else statement, but if it is 2, we execute the second code block. And at the end of the second code block, there is a jump to the end. So if we're here at the else statement, that means that EAX was not 1, it was not 2, so we execute the third code block. Notice the unconditional jumps, well, actually, the various jumps at the end of each code block to make sure that only one of these code blocks is executed for a given condition. Any questions about this? Well, let's start to, yeah. Yes, of course.
Have you come across
into source code?
Yeah. I mean, well, you can't translate.
Well, one-to-one
mapping, but
Steve is saying, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a tool that looked at the assembly code and gave us at least pseudocode? This is a tool known as a decompiler, and there are some decompilers. The best known decompiler in the marketplace is probably the one produced by Hexrays. And it's the same company that makes IDA Pro, the disassembler, but they now are putting all of their effort into developing a decompiler. And from what I hear, I haven't used it myself, from what I hear, it's pretty good. And it's able to produce ugly but readable source code. So that's very impressive. It's a tool that costs, about $5,000, I think, per license. So it's not cheap. More expensive than IDA Pro, of course, but also, I mean, it'll save you a lot of time. Yeah. Yep. And if there are areas that it cannot translate, I believe that's when it shows you assembly code. But there are a lot of blocks of code that it will be able to translate into C or into whatever source code, you're configuring it to use. Yeah. So let's talk about looping, because you're going to see a lot of loops. The idea behind loops is that there's going to be a set of instructions that you want to execute multiple number of times. And you can implement loops using the same jumps that I've already talked about earlier. But also, because loops are so common, Intel has a specialized loop instruction. And loop instruction is similar in its syntax to jump in that following the loop statement, there could be some characters that represent a condition. For example, you might see loop NZ, which says loop if not zero. What is it looking at to determine whether something is zero or not? The loop statement, by definition, uses the ECX register as its counter. So one of the nice things about a loop statement is that you don't manually have to increment any counters. Loop will automatically, every time it loops, will decrement ECX by one. And if you have a statement that like loop by itself, it's going to loop as long as ECX is not zero. So what if ECX is already used by another operation? Can't happen. The compiler's job is to make sure that if loop is trying to use the ECX register, no other instruction uses it. So that's, you know, why it's so hard to write compilers that don't have bugs in them. It's the compiler's job to make sure that one register does not somehow conflict with itself. Yeah. So loop uses ECX as a register behind the scenes and supports the same types of conditions that jumps support. Like loop NZ will loop if ECX is not zero. Loop by itself will loop if ECX is not zero as well, but it's a slightly different kind of jump. Yeah. So you're saying, so how do, if you have multiple threads running in parallel to each other, won't they be able to interfere with each other?
Yeah, can't they step on each other through the registers?
Can they step through each other in the registers? So I have not programmed, oh boy, it takes
you
me back.
To,
yeah.
I can take it offline because I don't want to waste time, but it's just like a interesting.
So when it comes to variables, certainly it is possible for threads to access each other's variables, and when programming with threads, you have to be careful so that threads don't try to write to the same variable at the same time. I don't remember, or actually I don't know how threads use registers. Does anybody know? Have you done assembly level programming in threads? So you're saying there are some functions that are thread safe, and if you use that function, that the implementation of that function will make sure that threads don't compete for the same data. So you're saying that it's the CPU's job, basically, to make sure that if S threads start executing, the register states is temporarily saved and restored, just like it would do that for various processes. Okay, so there's the answer. Thank you very much. I want to show you some examples. The best way to understand loops is to look through examples, but before I show you some examples, I want to highlight to you the process that you would use to understand what the loop is about. When you think you're dealing with a loop, which is a block of code that executes several times, there are several elements that you're always going to be looking for. First of all, you're going to look to see what is the control variable. A loop is typically going to have some control variable that it's going to look at to determine whether it's time to stop looping. You're going to need to identify that control variable. There's usually going to be some kind of a loop initialization statement that will set that loop variable to its initial value. You will need to find that statement so that you know what is the control variable start with. Then there's going to be, of course, the loop body, that block of code that actually does what's really important for the program to do. Then there's going to be some kind of a loop update statement. This is a statement that will update the control variable, because if the control variable does not get updated, it'll loop forever. And then lastly, there's going to be a stopping condition or stopping conditions that define when it's time to stop looping. So these five components is what you look for when you're trying to understand how the loop works. And let me show you an example. This one is taken from the bagelworm. We see that this is a loop. This is the way IDA Pro would show it to you. A quick way to identify loops in IDA Pro is to look at the leftmost margin, and you can see that it shows you arrows whenever there are loops or jumps. And if you see an arrow going upwards, not always, but in many cases, indicates that it's some kind of a loop. Because you have executed one code block, and then there's a jump backwards to execute it again. So a quick way to visually identify possible loops is to look at the upwards arrows on the left margin of IDA Pro. And OliDebug shows you similar arrows, but they're more like brackets and they're a little bit harder to visually identify. IDA Pro does a better job with this. Where the arrow starts is usually where the jump that implements the loop begins. And if you look there, we actually have a specialized statement called loop. And it says, can loop all the way starting from the address 40342E which is where this arrow is pointing. So this is the beginning of the loop, 403, 42, to F, all the way to the loop statement. So this is where our loop is defined.